When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. And Howard, has your outrage subsided over the addition of Andrew Wiggins to the All-Star team?
I have so much outrage that I nearly threw my back out shoveling snow yesterday just to channel that outrage somewhere.
See, you make jokes, though, but, like, people are crazy. Like, the outrage over Andrew Wiggins being named a starter. Now, I get it. Like, you can be outraged over the Warriors being smarter than everybody else, playing the system, getting that K-pop star involved to goose the votes for Andrew Wiggins. But if you're pissed at that, also be pissed at the players who gave Andrew Wiggins a whole bunch of votes to get him into that starting spot. It wasn't just the fans that were voting for Andrew Wiggins.
Well, I'll say this. I have a strict policy against having any outrage at all over things like All-Star snubs. It's a silly, overwrought, ridiculous annual discussion. But, you know, it gets us through podcasts and radio shows, so we do it. And fans got to rage on Twitter because that's what fans are on Twitter to do. Look, was he the most deserving third front court member in the Western Conference? No. Draymond Green, his own teammate, was probably a better choice, though Draymond may not have been able to make it anyway because of injury. We'll see. Rudy Gobert certainly, I think, has a right to feel a little snubbed. Again, I'm not outraged on his behalf. I don't care. But was he a better candidate? Yes. Did you and I both vote for him on our official media ballots? Yes. Did the media overall have Gobert as the third guy? Yeah. But the players didn't. The fans didn't. And so,
what do you make of that, by the way? What do you make of the players not having Gobert as high as they should?
Let's come back to that for a second.
Okay.
The NBA changed the system a few years ago because they worried after there was the massive Zaza Pachulia influx of votes from Georgia, not Georgia the state, but Georgia the country on the other side of the world. And the league was worried that this whole thing was now subject to some messing around with. So they wanted to balance this out, make sure that the fan vote was not all encompassing. And so they created this new system with media getting 25% and players getting 25%, fans getting 50%. So the tie still goes to the fan vote. The fans still have the majority of the influence. But in theory, this new system was to backstop it so that you couldn't have something outrageous happen. Andrew Wiggins is not outrageous. Andrew Wiggins is in most years, we'd call him like a bubble candidate, right? We'd say he's a fringe candidate, which means you're still a candidate. I don't begrudge him getting All-Star. I don't think starter makes sense. And the NBA's system clearly did not. I don't think it worked, frankly. But you ask about the players. I mean, where do the players have Gobert? I think fourth behind Draymond.
He wasn't, I don't think, in the top three.
I think he was fourth behind Draymond, if I recall correctly. So, it's that even that is not like that. Like if that's not an indication that the players don't respect Rudy Gobert, it's just that they had more respect for what the Warriors had done. And given that the Warriors are having this revival season, it makes perfectly good sense that players around the league respecting what Draymond does, that look, he's not a guy who's a statistical all-star, but he's the hub of their offense, the backbone of their defense, and the Warriors are a contender again.
So let me,
Steph is not the only one responsible for that.
Just to clarify, I was wrong on that. The players, 58 votes for Draymond Green, 52 for Rudy Gobert, and 46 for Andrew Wiggins. But it was those 46 that helped Wiggins get into that starting lineup when you factor that into what he got with the fan voting. Because the media voting, he didn't get barely anything at all. He got, Gobert got 65 votes from the media votes. Green got 20 and Wiggins just got 4. So it was the players that pushed Andrew Wiggins over the top. So get as mad as you want about, you know, it's not fair that, you know, K-pop stars can create all-stars, but it's not just that. It's also the players pushing Andrew Wiggins to get this far.
But I do think, because this is the other thing, right? If the media and the players split on who the second guard is or the third front court player is, it leaves it vulnerable to the fan vote as being dominant in the overall calculation. And so, and that, you know, that's kind of what happened here. So I don't know. I wonder if the league, I've not asked anybody this question because I didn't really care that much, but I might ask anyway now that I'm curious about it, now that we're talking about it. I wonder if the league will consider any other tweaks to the process.
There's no solution.
Not because Wiggins is so outrageous. I don't want this to be an insult to Andrew Wiggins, but just because I'm not sure if this is the way the system or the outcome the system was designed to create.
There's no solution. You can make it 100% fans and you will get like some foreign-born player that doesn't deserve to be in the starting lineup into the starting lineup. Or you will have influential pop stars from all corners of the world having an oversized impact on these votes. You could give it to the media, I'd kind of be okay with that. Like, I mean, I spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about who the starting lineup should be, which I think you should do, right? Like,
yes.
You should commit time and energy to votes like this. Or you can give it to the coaches, you want to give it to the players. Well, I don't know. Either way, no matter what happens, there's always going to be some flaw in the system that people are going to get upset about.
Two last thoughts on this. One is, the All-Star game, unlike all NBA, look, it's based on only a half season. It's not the same level of honor. And there is this philosophy or this thought out there that, you know, may or may not really be the case that, well, this is the fans' game. The All-Star game is the fans' game. So the fans get, in the past, 100% of the vote, now 50% of the vote, because it's for the fans. So if we want to call it a quote-unquote popularity contest, it's okay because it results in getting players in an event that's made for TV that doesn't matter anyway, and that is for the fans. Of course, it is also part of a guy's overall NBA resume. We use number of All-Star games, a number of All-NBA, a number of everything else to judge where a guy fit into his era, where he fits in historically, how, you know, where he is in the overall top 25, the top 100, the top 500, whatever. This stuff all matters, and so there is that. I do think if the NBA, and again, this is a big if, I don't know what they're thinking on this, if the NBA sees this result as, another warning sign that maybe this system can still be hijacked, you could ratchet down the fan vote to 25%, or maybe it's 33 1/3, and we go 33. There are other ways they could do it to reduce how much weight the fan vote gets.
Well, yeah, but even if you did that, like, Wiggins would still have a shot at getting in because he did get 46 votes from players. So
I don't know. But I think,
I don't know. It'd still be close.
It's the rankings. It's the way we all ended up ranking. It's the media rankings, not the number of votes. It's who got first, second, third with the media, first, second, third with the players. So I don't think it's number of votes that matters.
All right. Well, either way, the player, I wasn't shocked by fans voting for Wiggins because you saw that coming based on the early returns. I was surprised at how many votes he got from players in that regard, which, by the way, and I know you're not saying this, but Andrew Wiggins, pretty good player this year. 18
yes.
points per game, 40 yeah. plus percent from three, great defense for a top team in the Western Conference. Not bad numbers, like pretty good.
And a really important defender for them.
Very
important. Like, they're a great defensive team, and they've been that
without the backbone of what made them a great defensive team the last time that they were a contender, right? No Kevin Durant, no Klay Thompson for most of this season, and Klay is not that Klay yet. No Sean Livingston. No, you know, we've got an older Andre Iguodala there. This is not the same group that made them a strong defensive team in the past. And one of the reasons they've been able to be a contender again, Steph's offense and Steph's gravity and Steph's everything, for sure. But without Klay there, without any other, you know, big time star, you know, it's been Draymond and Andrew Wiggins creating their defensive backbone. And that Wiggins is rewarded for that along with his offensive contributions. It's not crazy. I mean, should he have been a starter? I mean, obviously you and I disagree because neither of us voted for him, but this is not the same thing as Zaza Pachulia potentially getting in.
Shout out Rudy Gobert. You belonged in there, but
he'll make it. The coaches will pick him.
Absolutely. You've had a heck of a season. All right. I want to talk about a few things today. I want to talk about Russell Westbrook, and is there a team out there that he should be traded to? I want to talk about the surging Hawks. I've been watching a lot of Atlanta the last few games, playing some good basketball, a couple of things as well. But let's start with Westbrook, who is not really fitting in with the Lakers, to say it lightly at this point. The Lakers just finished a 2-4 road trip. They lost to Atlanta. I don't know how big their lead was at one point against the Hawks. They had a great first half.
15 maybe, something.
Yeah, it was a big first half. Their only wins on that road trip came against Orlando and against the Zombie Nets. So 2-4 was... they were lucky to get away kind of with 2-4. Now they go back home, and we're approaching the trade deadline, and we're nowhere near ready to say that Russell Westbrook works in there. In fact, we're probably ready to say the exact opposite. It doesn't work in LA. Now, trade partners for Westbrook are almost non-existent. I mean, I keep hearing this John Wall. That doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know that John Wall helps the Lakers right now, having not played in, what, almost a year at this point. So I don't know if that's a big boost to them. The Rockets, of course, their only interest is getting a draft pick back in return, and they'd cut Westbrook or buy out Westbrook right away. The team that's interesting, and you and I disagree on this, I know this already, the New York Knicks. The New York Knicks are playing some bad basketball. We're recording this before the game against Sacramento on Monday night, so whatever. But before then, they lost, I think, 6 out of 7, and none of it's been looked good. Julius Randle has been a fraction of the player we saw last year when he was an all-NBA forward with the Knicks. RJ Barrett's shooting percentages have dropped significantly. Derrick Rose's injury has really hurt this team because he was such a big factor in what they did last year, but they're just not the same team. They are a bottom third in the NBA offense. They are middle of the pack defensively after finishing in the top three last season. That was a big reason why they were so good in the regular season. I don't know, Howard. I feel like I'm here arguing, and I kind of am, that the Knicks should take a swing at Russell Westbrook. Now, Bobby Marks, our friend over at ESPN, he proposed this kind of idea of a Kemba Walker, Evan Fournier, Alec Burks deal for Westbrook and a protected 2027 first-round pick. I might do that if I was the Knicks. They're just lifeless right now. And this version of Westbrook is not the version of years past. Still the same player, but that contract isn't quite so bad anymore because he's got the rest of this season, all of next season, and then after next season, you get like $47 million coming off your books if you're the Knicks, which for New York, you would figure would be useful. Like, you know, that's something, that kind of cap flexibility is not something they've often had in New York. So I kind of like it for the Knicks. You know, your team's going nowhere. Your team's playing lifelessly. Westbrook kind of makes in a weird way makes some sense then. What do you think?
I think I've seen this play too many times before, having been in New York for nearly 18 years and having covered that team up close for 9 of them, that this feels way too much like the bad old Knicks of the last 20 years, where every deal is swinging for the fences. Every deal is the quick fix. Every deal is sacrificing the future for the present. And this seems like more of that. Now, in the scenario you outlined, and maybe, you know, cribbing a little from what our friend Bobby Marks outlined, if it's just guys who aren't fitting anyway, right? Like Kemba and Fournier, those offseason
Kemba and Fournier have not fit in. Kemba is at this point unplayable for them, and Fournier is only good against the Celtics.
Yeah, and they're veterans. So you're not sacrificing anything there. At least you're not sending out young players or picks. Alec Burke's a nice piece, but again, not part of some long-term future for the Knicks. If that's all it took, I still, listen, the one thing you said that got my attention that made me think maybe is the future first, especially if it's unprotected, because the Lakers are already, like, you know, they're not crashing and burning, but, like, you could already see, like, something smoldering there. And by 2027, when LeBron is 40?
Not a Laker. I'm going to just go out and
not
say,
a Laker. Like, yeah. Wait, LeBron just turned 37, right? 37, so he'll be 42?
Yes. So we got five years from now.
That pick is really far out there. I don't know what Anthony Davis is by then. I don't know where LeBron is, if Bronny Jr. is now the Lakers franchise player. I don't know where the Lakers are in 2027, but the chances that that might be a good pick and also just a good chip to use in the meantime if the Knicks need to use it in a subsequent deal, I like that. I like the idea of the 2027 Lakers pick much better than I like the addition of Russell Westbrook to the Knicks. Because if it's just a quick fix, Chris, start with who's still there. Julius Randle operated at an all-NBA level last season. Granted, the only time in his career he has done so. So now that looks absolutely like the outlier, right? Didn't do it before last season, not doing it after last season. So maybe we should just dismiss last season entirely. But as their number one option, as the guy they play everything through, he was really good. Sharing the ball with Kemba and Fournier and others has made him chafe. Asking Julius Randle to now accommodate Russell Westbrook, one of the highest usage players in the history of the sport, that ain't going to work. Like, that is not going to bring back all NBA version of Julius Randle or make him particularly happy. Russell Westbrook jacking up, you know, long twos and pull-up threes late in the fourth quarter while Randall's yelling for the ball. Like, that's a disaster waiting to happen. And let's be clear, like, this Westbrook is not a difference maker anymore. And really hasn't been for a while. Since losing Kevin Durant as his teammate back in 2016, Westbrook's led a team out of the first round once, and it's questionable whether we could say led because it was him and Harden together. And by the way, it took seven games to beat an Oklahoma City Thunder team that wasn't even supposed to make the playoffs. And then after beating them in seven games, they went and got crushed by the Lakers. Other than that, Westbrook's teams have been bounced pretty handily in the first round every time, no matter who his teammates are. And I just don't see that. Like, aside from the thrill of the Garden getting to watch Westbrook play, he's still fun to watch when he's not driving you crazy. But Knicks fans are going to, like, you know, gouge their eyes. Like, they're going to be screaming, cheering for him 1 minute, and then, like, you know, screaming at him the next when he's throwing up some of those awful fourth quarter shots or turning the ball over. So, but that 2027 first round pick sounds like fun.
Look, if you're the Lakers too, like, you know, could Evan Fournier help you? Maybe. You know, you need shooters around the guys that you have. You know, Kemba, could he help you? Alec Burks, could he help you? Yeah, like, sure. Theoretically,
I don't mind from the Lakers side.
They could help you, and they'd certainly be more helpful than Westbrook. I mean, the best game that Westbrook played on this recent road trip was against Charlotte, and he did it when LeBron and Anthony Davis weren't playing. So, like, you know, it's a conundrum because you want the best of Westbrook, but you only get that when your other two stars are not in the lineup. And you're not going to win anything like that. So I don't know what they do.
And the Knicks wouldn't win anything like that either. Like, if they made the playoffs at all, not a guarantee even with Westbrook, if they made it, they're a first round out.
They're just so lifeless.
That's the thing. Where does it get them? How does it move the ball forward for the Knicks?
Like, they're just so lifeless. Like, it's just hard to watch. They're, like, hiding Julius Randle from the media, you know, over the last few weeks.
Oh, and that part is just ridiculous. And then, you know, Julius Randle's telling the media, oh, they didn't want me to talk. Like, I'm sorry. Franchises are not supposed to tell their players not to talk. If the player is going to lose it and there's like a one-off one night where it's like, if I talk, I'm just going to get fined and everything. And I don't, you know, because of the referees or whatever, fine, but not for like a week, which I believe is what they did. Like, that's just amateurish of the organization to do that. I think the Lakers did the same thing with Westbrook recently, didn't they?
They did after the game he sat late in the fourth quarter.
Right, but I think that was only for a day. But still, like, bad micro trend, teams telling their their player who's under fire not to talk. Like, come on, folks. And then taking, whether it's them taking the bullet for the player by them saying it was the organization or and covering for them, or whether the, in, especially in the Knicks case, whether they truly just stepped in and just said, we don't want to take a risk that he's going to say something controversial, which, by the way, is very much a Jim Dolan kind of thing. Like, that's, if there's one thing I learned the moment I got to New York, it's that he is allergic to controversy, even the smallest controversy. He would rather have none of his players and none of his employees ever speak to the media at all, because he is so fearful that somebody will say something that becomes a headline. It's, he hates that more than he hates losing, clearly, because he does more to prevent one than the other.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll see what happens. A couple weeks to go before that trade deadline. Let's talk about the Hawks for a second here. Hawks have suddenly won 7 straight, and they're still playing great offense, but it's the defense that has turned the corner. Over the last 7 games, their defense has been top 5 in the NBA in efficiency, and they've been on this stretch against good teams, not just beating up on bad teams. They have a win over Milwaukee. They have a win over Miami. Like, they beat Boston. Now they beat the Lakers. Like, they're surging at the right time against good teams. Now, we know, Howard, Atlanta had their struggles last year at the start of the season. Those struggles changed in part after they made a coaching change to Nate McMillan. No change here, but you think it's possible we're kind of seeing the switch flipped for Atlanta? Because we've always known they're a great offensive team. They've got a lot of firepower on that team. Defensively, though, if they can play anywhere in the neighborhood of top 10 defense, I think they're dangerous. I just don't know. I need to see how sustainable this is over the next few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's too soon to say. It's an impressive stretch. It's too soon to say this means that they're back and we should put them in the mix for, you know, winning the East or going to the conference finals. Like, it's way too soon for any of that, given how just, you know, horribly they played for the first couple of months. There's a funny, is this coincidence? Is this, causation or just correlation? Is it whatever, however you want to look at this? They kind of take it off since they traded Cam Reddish. And look, I'm not here to say that Cam Reddish is the reason that the Hawks were bad and Cam Reddish's absence is the reason that they're good now. That would be ridiculous, clearly. But I will say this, and I ran this by an NBA team executive earlier today, actually, just to see what they thought. The part of it that is not outlandish is this. We know that the Hawks had too many guys who need minutes, who have talent, who need roles, who weren't getting it or weren't getting enough of a role, and that part of the problem with their chemistry was just too many guys who, whether they deserve it or not, thought they should be playing much bigger roles, right? That is the issue of the Hawks. Almost too much talent. So they cleared the decks a little bit. You know, like, just getting rid of Reddish doesn't clarify everything, but it's one less brooding person in the room who thinks, I should be getting more run. And maybe that's helped a little bit. Again, it's ridiculous to say they're turning their season around because they traded Cam Reddish. It is not ridiculous to think that they needed to thin the herd a little bit and be more focused on who their core was, and that clarity and maybe removing one sour personality might have helped a little bit. Maybe.
No, I buy that. The defensive turnaround is just remarkable to me. I mean, some of these numbers are wild. I mean, during this winning streak, the Hawks are holding teams to 43.7% field goal percentage, the third lowest in the NBA. 31% from three, that's the fourth lowest in the NBA. About 107 points per game, that's ninth lowest in the NBA. I mean, their defense has been excellent during this stretch. And just as important, and maybe this has something to do with that kind of thinning the herd thing, Howard, but their bench has been great. I mean, they've outscored opponents' benches by plus 92 over the last 3 games. Over the last 7, this winning streak, the bench is averaging 52% from the floor. That's number 1 in the NBA. 10 assists per game, that's number 2 in the NBA. 38% from 3, that's number 5 in the NBA. Getting to the free throw line a lot, getting steals. You're looking at Bogdanovich settling into a role. You're looking at Danilo Gallinari settling into a role. They just seem really comfortable in the roles that they're in. And I give Nate McMillan some credit. Against the Lakers, like, the bench was rolling for a while, and Nate just stuck with them and was letting Trae Young play out there with a bunch of reserves. So, I mean, with maybe a little bit more definition to your point of roles with this team, I mean, they're starting to figure some things out. Now, they could just easily revert to the norm and be terrible defensively, but, I mean, this team looks like some of what we're seeing has staying power.
I'm trying to think, because there's been some other teams in the past that inexplicably, I think maybe the Nuggets during like the end of Carmelo's years there. I'm trying to think of who else was like this. There were a couple teams in the past where it was like, they always were a little shaky over the first half of the season. Like the Jazz for a while there, the first couple months of the season would be dragging for a little bit and then suddenly would kick into high gear in like early January. So like this happens sometimes. Teams that have the talent to be a top tier team and they just start slow. And this Hawks team maybe got a little too high on itself and maybe just took
a while
to realize.
True. I think they definitely did. Early on, I think they did. Yeah. Early, I mean, what was that Trae Young line about kind of, you know, like, not like the regular season's tough. Like that's a tough line to deliver if you're not named LeBron James.
Right. Or if you're not somebody who's been there year in, year out, like it's too early in your career for you to be saying, we're just going to kind of like coast through the regular season because the real season is in the spring. Like you can't do that. When you haven't been there for very long. So maybe they're just a slow starting team. Maybe they just need, you know, to get their butts kicked a little bit before they focus. The talent is there. That's the thing, Chris, here, Chris, that we should have confidence in. Like, were they legitimately an Eastern Conference Finals team last season? I don't know. But
they benefited greatly from, you know, the Knicks were not as good,
sure,
at least as a playoff team we thought they were. The Sixers,
yeah,
kind of a mess, as it turns out.
Right.
So they definitely benefited from matchups.
But we all respected the Hawks' talent, right? We thought,
yeah,
maybe it was too soon for them to be making that big of a leap, but we all respected the talent there. So the part of this that seems sustainable is, yeah, we already knew they had great talent. Like, we already knew that they've got great depth. They just need to pull it together. And so if it was a chemistry issue and they're working that out, or if it was a motivation issue and they're working that out, like it's all plausible that this is a really strong second half team, and that they're still going to be heard from in the playoffs, that they're going to be making a lot of noise. Like, this is, you know, they're not the top tier, right? The top tier is still Milwaukee as defending champs, Miami, and the Nets if and when they're ever at full strength. And then the Hawks are in that second tier with, like, you know, Philly. I don't know who else deserves to even be mentioned in that tier, but if there's a second tier, like, Atlanta and Philly feel like it.
Yeah. So as we record this, they're about five games out of that number six seed. So they're still looking in kind of that play-in range with Charlotte, Toronto, Boston. Washington kind of bottomed out, but they're in the mix. The Knicks are right there, at least theoretically, as well. So it seems like they're going to wind up in that mix. But if they wind up as a 7 or 8 seed getting through the play-in, if I'm Miami, Chicago, Philadelphia, Cleveland, whoever's in that first, the top half of the Eastern Conference playoff bracket, that's not a team I'd want to play in the first round. Like,
no.
That's a middle-of-the-pack playoff team that's masquerading as a lower seed because of issues they had this year. Like, that's a better team than what they'd be seeded as.
Yeah. And look, I should mention the Cavaliers in that second tier, too.
We got to do a whole show sometime on the Cavaliers.
Like, I mean, the record suggests that they're a top 3 or 4 team in the East, obviously. And they're just a harder one to assess, like, for all of us, I think, right? Cleveland and Memphis, we're all going to be sitting there going, wow, it's so impressive what they're doing. They're fun to watch. This is great. We all appreciate it. We all respect it. I think we're all going to look at it, and people around the league look at it with a little bit of skepticism, only because these are teams that just broke through to this level and they're really young in key places, and it's hard to know what's sustainable and also how that how they withstand the intensity of the playoffs, because this Cleveland team hasn't been there and this Memphis team has barely been there. But yeah, the Hawks on talent and experience should be able to bust through. And if they're as you said it, if they're part of the lower part of the bracket, they are a team nobody in the first round is going to want to face.
No, you're right. Let's finish in Sacramento, because I want to ask you about the Kings. And we'll get deeper into Ben Simmons next week when we get closer to the trade deadline, do a full show on the trade deadline. But the report last week that the Kings had bowed out of the Ben Simmons sweepstakes, effectively saying that the price was too high. And we've heard for several weeks now, you know, that the Kings were declaring certain players untouchable. They were committed to De'Aaron Fox. They were committed to Tyrese Halliburton. I don't really know what that leaves them to deal ultimately. Harrison Barnes' contract, Marvin Bagley. I don't know. Nothing that really interests any team with something to deal back. I guess the question is, like, should anybody be off limits for Sacramento? I mean, this was a team that went into Boston and got beaten worse than I've seen a team get beaten in my life. Like, that was, at one point, they're down 60. They wound up losing by 53. Then the next night, they go to Atlanta, and they're getting just hammered all over the court. They rallied a little bit towards the end, but that was back-to-back just pastings that they took on the road. So, yeah, if you're Monty McNair, Wes Wilcox, like, should anybody be off limits if you're trying to make a deal? And do you go all in for a player like Ben Simmons?
Listen, I want to hit the Sixers side of this, but we'll come back to that. Let me answer your question first. On the Kings side of this, given where they've been for the last, what are we on, 16 years? 17? I've lost count of how long it's been since the Kings were last in the playoffs. They have the longest drought in NBA history. Given where they've been, given where they are right now, it's easy to say, you know what? Nothing should be off the table. Nobody should be untouchable. If your team is still this bad, despite having a couple players you're really high on, well, maybe you're too high on them. Like, that's a valid snap perspective, right? De'Aaron Fox does have talent, though, and does have value. Tyrese Halliburton definitely has talent and has value. They've got some other players who are really good pieces on somebody else's team. The combination isn't working. They need to do something. I'd be shocked if they don't move somebody, whether it's Barnes, whether it's Bagley, whether it's Hield. Somebody is going. They're going to make some moves before February 10th. I am almost certain of that. But the big move, you know, how all in do you have to be for Ben Simmons, Chris? Like, this is the question. And this is where it goes back to a Philly discussion more than a Kings discussion, I think. If getting Ben Simmons costs you your two best players, Fox and Halliburton, he's coming to play with who? How much more work does it take then to build up around him?
Buddy Hield.
Yeah. And is Ben Simmons worth Halliburton and Fox? Like, I know there's that sounds crazy considering that Ben Simmons has been a top 15 player. He's been all NBA within the last couple of years, and Fox and Halliburton do not have those kinds of credentials, but those guys are still really young and have shown tremendous potential. That might be too steep. So let me, on that note, if you don't mind, let me swing this back to the Philly side of it. What we keep hearing, what I've heard again recently, Philly's asking for way more when they actually talk to teams than what they're hinting at publicly or what Daryl Morey is saying when he's on radio. Like, they're putting it out there that it's kind of more reasonable. Oh, we're not insisting on top 20 anymore. Now we're only insisting on top 30, Daryl said. What he's actually doing in negotiations with teams is asking for, from what I understand, absolutely everything. So when the Kings said, we're out, or whoever they leaked that to, or I don't even remember what the line of reporting was, apologies to whoever reported it, but the Kings basically deciding that they're out was, I think, more of a throwing up their hands like, there's not a deal to be made here because they basically want everything of value that we have and then some. Somebody put it in this framework or described it this way, that Daryl is trying to get basically twice the package that the Rockets got for James Harden from Brooklyn. Twice. Now, even if that's a little bit exaggerated, it's still too much. And Ben Simmons is not nearly as accomplished as Harden. Younger than Harden, sure. But he hasn't been an MVP, and James Harden has. He hasn't been a scoring champion, and James Harden has. So if that's true, if the Sixers are asking for somewhere in the neighborhood of double what the Rockets got for James Harden, then there's not a deal to be made. But I think that there might be a different end game there, but we'll come back to that. I want to hear what you think.
Yeah. So my opinions on the Kings have varied a lot in recent days, weeks, whatever. A couple of weeks ago, I would have said, just, you know, break the whole damn thing up. Like, you know, Fox, Hield, Halliburton, yeah. Like, nothing's really working there. And then they go and get tattooed by Boston, then Atlanta, and just seemed like it reinforced it. I did talk recently to an assistant coach who is going to be in the mix for available head coaching jobs this offseason, including the one in Sacramento. And what this coach told me was, he's like, I want that Kings job. And I was kind of taken aback. I'm like, all right, why? He's like, I think they're a lot closer to winning than people think. And he's mentioning the fact that Fox, even though he's had a down year, it's probably just that. Like, his numbers, shooting numbers this year are way down. Like, his field goal percentage is down almost 3 points. His three-point shooting percentage down 8 points at about 25%. There's a belief, at least amongst the people I've talked to, and specifically this assistant coach, that Fox can be turned around. Halliburton is still good. Heald is good, but like, Heald's not long for that team. And you're probably going to throw a top 10 pick, maybe even a top 5 pick, into the mix next season. So
sure,
there's just a belief that maybe the Kings, as dysfunctional as this season has been, aren't that far off. That's like the biggest reason why I'm like, all right, maybe you don't go all in for Ben Simmons. Maybe you swallow the rest of this season. You move off Harrison Barnes, you know, get rid of him, see what you can get back in return for him. If you can get a deal for Buddy Hield, maybe you do that. But the core of this team, which is really just Halliburton Fox, is what we're talking about. But the core of this team, you keep intact and you build around them. You bring another lottery pick in and you add the right coach to that mix. That's been a big problem for this team. Like, Alvin Gentry's fine, don't get me wrong, but he's a takeover midseason type of coach. Luke Walton, start of the year in Sacramento. I was influenced by what this coach said. It's like, I really believe that team is closer than most people think to being something. You know, maybe not a winner playoff team next year, but on that track. And this coach wanted to be on board with that. Like, he wanted to be part of what the Kings are going to do rather than what they are right now.
Well, so first of all, Halliburton has been spectacular over the last like 3-4 weeks.
Good player.
Playing at like near all-star type level. I don't know if Halliburton charts out eventually as an all-star, but he's got some definite ability, and plus he's just a really versatile player. We know De'Aaron Fox has that potential at his best. Yes, he's been up and down, he's been frustrating, but it's way too soon to give up on him. And Davion Mitchell, the rookie.
Yeah, like, I forgot. Really high. Great defender.
I mean, their three best players are guards, and so how that pans out ultimately is Fox. I wonder a little bit, you know, is Fox regressing a little bit because Halliburton is assuming more and more responsibility, and is that hard for Fox to kind of adjust to? You know, similar to, you know, the Cavaliers tried to figure it out between Sexton and Garland until finally Sexton got hurt, and now it's Garland's show, and that clarified it for them. You look at the Kings roster, and which, by the way, quick thing here, the failures of the last 15 whatever years for the Kings, you can always trace it back to ownership. That's always fair. I think that Vivek Ranadive bears a lot of responsibility, just as, you know, Jim Dolan does in New York, just as any of these owners do anywhere where their team has been perpetually bad. But this front office is still like 18 months in. Like, the Monty McNair, Wes Wilcox front office really just got there, inherited the coach, inherited the roster, inherited all the problems that went with it. And you and I, it's easy for us to sit back and say, well, they should have blown it up by now, or they should have made some moves by now. I mean, yeah, maybe they should have, but it's hard to make deals in this league, as you and I know. As I say, I'll be shocked if they don't do something by the February 10th deadline, and then we'll get to the offseason and they'll have more room to maneuver once more. So there is talent there. That's the good news. There is, I think, a pretty smart front office there. They just, you know, it's a matter of opportunity. Let me get back to Philly. Because
you're dying to keep talking about Philly.
I stuck a pin in this. I got to come back to the pin I stuck. There's a belief out there that they're really just running out the clock of this thing. That all of the whether the posturing and trade and all the big trade demands are just the Sixers overplaying their hand, or whether that's intentional to just slow roll this thing. There is certainly a belief out there among some quarters that what they really want is what they always wanted: Damian Lillard, Bradley Beal, James Harden. And you're not probably getting any of those guys in a deal between now and February 10th, but you might in June or July. And so, you know, the Sixers are playing so well right now, and Joel Embiid's been so dominant. Maybe it has bought them a certain, internal comfort that, you know what, we can ride this out. And the East is wide open. Who knows? Like, is it crazy to think that the Sixers could make the finals
even without Simmons or a trade package back for Simmons. Like right now, the way they're playing, they're like, as you and I speak, I think they are a game back in the loss column from first place in the East. So if their idea is, let's just let the season go, we'll make one more run at trying to get Ben Simmons to come back and play. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. Probably doesn't. Okay, and then in a few months, it's the offseason again. We see what we do in the playoffs. And now, look, the Wizards look like they're in an absolute tailspin. And so the clock should be ticking once again on the Bradley Beal, it's time to ask out scenario. Dame Lillard, I know we keep doing this, and Dame Lillard keeps telling us all to shut up. I'm sticking to Portland, and maybe he will. Maybe this offseason is different. Or maybe the Blazers themselves decide, you know what, we got to find a new way forward. That would not be shocking. And with the Nets, as we know, there's been plenty of James Harden speculation. We discussed this last week. If Harden decides this is not the place for him. So if those three guys are potentially in play this summer, and you want to hold on to Ben Simmons for that opportunity so that you then have 3, 4, 5, however many years of Embiid and Lillard, Embiid and Beal, Embiid and Harden, that's not the most unreasonable scenario to contemplate if you're Philly.
No, it's not. And we'll get deeper into this next week, but I'm starting to wonder how available Beal might be before the deadline. I mean, if you're Washington, like, what are you doing? What are you holding on to him for? Like,
if they make him available, isn't that Ben Simmons trade happening tomorrow?
I mean, I would think that's a pretty good fit right there. Ben Simmons, still just 25, kind of fits in with some of the young guys they've got there. Kind of fits into the kind of environment Ben Simmons wants to be in, low pressure at this point. I mean, again, we'll put a pin in that too, because we're going to do a whole big trade deadline. We're going to do a whole big trade deadline show next week to kind of dive into all that and much more. For now, Howard, good stuff, man. We'll do it again next time.
That was, by the way, your phone ringing. That was Damian Lillard telling us to stop talking
it
about
was,
him
actually.
Wanting out of
it
Portland.
It was Damian Lillard saying,
Shut up, guys.
Stop trying to trade me again. How much clearer do I have to be?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get 15% off a set of Brake Best Select, Select Pro, or Import Direct brake pads and two rotors now at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly Auto Parts.